Okay, once again, we are trying to encapsulate what we might call the Christ Prez way through this foundations class. And so there's really no better way, we hope, as we continue in the years ahead to offer this class to help you get a grasp over what we really want to be about as a church than this particular class. And so this class, this semester, is intending to introduce us to really what it means for us to be in life together with one another, and all of the ups and downs that come with that particular challenge and that particular struggle. So today we come, and we've been talking about the doctrine of the church, and each week we've been hinting at this idea that the relationships within the church constitute the real, most fundamental ground where God wants to do transformation in you. Unfortunately, we all tend to sort of gravitate towards transformation as being a purely individualized experience. This is something between me and God. It's during my quiet times. It's during my isolated moments of self-reflection. And I'm not diminishing any of that. Those are all important aspects of the inner life of a person. But the Bible's conception, though, of the majority of our growth as people come in this formation of these valued friendships. This deep, powerful connection that exists in the body of Christ that we call the church. So I'm trying to basically take the idea of church away from what we tend to associate it with, which is mostly this building, right? That's what church is. You know, here's the church, Les, here's the steeple. That's what a church is. I'm trying to sort of move away from that to where when you hear church, you hear, yeah, that's my family. That's my community. That's the place where I belong. That's what we're trying to sort of fashion here. And we come today, therefore, to the idea and the big topic of friendship. Now, look, I'm not sure if you're aware of it, but the word friendship can really be very confusing. And when I was doing campus ministry for so many years, you would find it fascinating that the same word used in different contexts can either represent bad news or good news. So let's take a single woman saying something to a single man, all right? And see if you can discern the difference in the meanings here. She says, I don't know, I guess I'm just feeling lonely. I really wish I could have a friend around. Okay, gentlemen, if you're a dude and you're single, that's really good news, right? Because I'm here, honey, right? I will be your comfort. Let me just put my arm around you, something subtle like that, right? But compare that with the second statement. She says, I don't know, I'm just not ready to commit right now. I really wish that I could just have a friend now. Now, gentlemen, you know, that's bad news. My students used to say, she just stuck me into the friend zone. You know, I don't like you that way. I just like you as a friend, which is sort of the immediate sort of check to get out. I do think, though, it shows at least a little bit of how often when we say that we need friendship and we talk about the idea of friendship, we don't always mean the same thing. Because a word can be used in different contexts and actually have very different associations for the people that use it. So what I want to sort of appeal to you with is to say that we are living in a time of unprecedented poverty when it comes to understanding friendships. And I want to offer two quotes here. The first one is from a former senator of Nebraska, Ben Sasse. Ben Sasse, actually, day before yesterday, just accepted a position as the president of the University of Florida. And one of my really good friends is a pastor of a PCA church there. And it turns out that Ben Sasse actually goes to a PCA church in Nebraska. So go figure. We might get Ben to come talk to us here. He's a really fascinating individual. But he was asked to speak a while back on the death of friendship and what's happened in our lives, especially the crisis among friends. He says this, he says, friendship is in an absolute devastating atrophy. Atrophy means because it's not being used, it dwindles. It's like your muscles, if you don't exercise them, will dwindle, they'll atrophy. Does that make sense? In 1990, when I graduated high school, the average American had 3.2 friends. Do you ever wonder if you were the 0.2 friend to somebody? Thank you, that was supposed to be funny. The average American today has 1.8 friends and having a friendship in 27 years or 28 years. There is no data that shows that you're happier when you go from 200 to 500 social media friends and from 500 to 1,000 social media friends. So the way in which this culture is defining friendship, it doesn't really change. Well, then listen to what he says after that. Here we go. He says, if you go from 1,000 to 5,000 social media friends, there's actually some data which suggests a mild decline in happiness because you're actually spending far more time grooming this online personality, which isn't who you actually are. And none of those people from 1,000 to 5,000 are going to come visit you when you're sick. Statistically, if you know the person who lives two doors down from you, you are much more likely to be happy than if you don't. There's a challenge, right? Look at my neighborhood. Then he finishes with this. He says, and if you spend more time on social media, you are less likely to know the person who lives two doors down from you. Social media can add genuine value when it's supplementing human flesh and blood bodily relationships. But when social media supplants bodily incarnate relationships, it has net destructive effects. Okay? So the proliferation and the growth of social media, you have seen the decline in actual genuine friendships. And it's being documented over and over and over again. And this is what's interesting. Don't assume that the next generation is not aware of this. They are, but they also don't know what to do about it. My daughters, you know, and my son have slowly, probably about a few years ago, started talking about how much they despise social media, but yet they're stuck in it because it's now the only form of social concourse, conversation that people have. Which leads me to another discussion on friendship by the late Kobe Bryant, great Lakers standout star, who was being interviewed about the difficulty of his friendship and especially his relationship with Michael Jordan, which, if any of you know, was always strained. Jordan never had very easy relationships with his spouses or children or otherwise. But Kobe was asked about his friendship with Michael Jordan. He said this. He said, well, yes and no. He said, I have friends, but being a great friend is something I will never be. Tell me if you feel this way. I can be a good friend, but not a great friend. A great friend will call you every day and remember your birthday. I like that definition. I'll get so wrapped up in my stuff that I'll never remember that stuff. And the people who are my friends understand this, and they're usually the same way. He says, you gravitate towards people who are like you, but the kind of relationships you see in the movies, that's impossible for me. I have good relationships with players around the league. LeBron and I will text every now and then. KG and I will text every now and then. But in terms of having one of those great bonding friendships, that's something I will probably never have. And that's not some smug thing. It's a weakness. Isn't this amazing he was being this vulnerable? He says, it's not like I'm saying I don't need friends because I'm so strong. It's a weakness. So even the late Kobe Bryant, which actually made his death a little more tragic for me in thinking about how awful that must have been, opens us up to this question of, what does the Bible say about the nature and fashioning of friendships? Well, I want to submit to you this morning that we have the idea of friendships rooted in the Christian understanding of marriage. This is going to sound really weird because we're getting to marriage actually next week as we dive into some of these topics. But the Christian framework for friendships is actually started in Genesis 2:18. Where God is creating all these things and he pronounces this good and that good, except there's one thing that is not good, and that is that man is alone. We've been talking about this so much this semester that I'm not going to rehash it again, but we're simply saying that our God is a Trinity, which means he has friendship within his own self-definition. Relationship in every other worldview has to be imported from the outside. But only in the Christian conception of God is friendship and relationship intrinsic. That's the word we're looking for. It's intrinsic to God's self-definition. You follow? That's huge. Which is the reason why man by himself was not a good thing. When everything else God was making in Genesis 1 and 2 was good. Trees are good, land's good, sky's good, sun and moon are good. It's not good that man should be alone. And so what you have there is this admission that I need something. I need someone. But when all of a sudden God brings the woman along, the man suddenly finds himself in very powerful ways. And yes, we've been trying to stress, especially from the pulpit the last couple of weeks, that the erotic connection between the man and the woman is unique to marriage. But the sense of connection with someone else is not. And I would argue that the latter is more fundamental than the former in the Christian conception. What do I mean by that? I mean that in the Christian conception of life, your deep and powerful connection with other believing people is more fundamental than even the sexual connections that exist between man and woman. Why would I say that? Well, because we know for a fact, when Jesus has his conversations with the Sadducees, that there will be a great and powerful change in the nature of how we understand sexuality in the new heavens and the new earth. Jesus says this to the Sadducees, in the new heavens and new earth, people will neither marry nor are given in marriage. Okay? Now, he may just mean that some people have said, oh, he means that there'll be no new marriages, whatever. But given the illustration that was said, it means probably there's going to be a dramatic change in what we understand about sexuality. But the bond that exists, the connection, the mutuality, the sense of being known, that doesn't go away. The sense of having a friendship doesn't go away. And for that reason, one of the reasons why I think our marriages struggle is because oftentimes we're trying to have a romantic relationship that is garnished with friendship rather than the other way around. Tim Keller makes the point that actually marriage should fundamentally be a friendship that is garnished with romance. And when we reverse those two, that's when the problems tend to start. And it reminded me of the Jerry Maguire scene that I've got right up there, where Jerry Maguire is this sports agent whose life has just come crashing down around him because he's just been fired. And the only person who's willing to stick with him is this rather random secretary played by Renee Zellweger. And at one point in the movie, they sort of, after they're fired, walk into an elevator, and in the elevator is occupied by two other deaf individuals, and they're signing to each other. And they sort of get off on the next floor down, and Jerry Maguire looks over at Renee Zellweger's character, and is kind of like, huh, I wonder what they were talking about. To which Zellweger says, I actually have a deaf aunt and can read sign language, and what she said was, you complete me. And there's this wonderful moment, and I'm certain that it was purposeful on behalf of Cameron Crowe who made this, that as soon as she says, you complete me, Tom Cruise does this. He goes, he furrows his brow as if to say, what in the world is that? And really, I would argue that the whole movie, watch the TBS edited version, it's far better. The whole movie is the journey that Jerry Maguire makes to learning how to be an authentic friend. And it's contrasted with this other individual that's played by Cuba Gooding. And throughout the whole movie is about their ability to have adult male friendships. And I'm kind of picking on the dudes here because we tend to have a greater struggle with this than do others. Okay? So C.S. Lewis began to really wrestle with this idea and make some profound connections when he brought this out in his book, The Four Loves. In The Four Loves, Lewis is trying to identify four different ways in which human beings feel this sense of love, or that we talk about love. The first way is what we call affection. This would simply be the kind of love that we do when we go to someone's home, maybe we bring them some help, maybe we're cordial to them on the street. It's sort of a friendship, how to have a nice society kind of love. I have a love and affection for all of God's creatures, and so therefore when someone's hurting, I'll make a donation to that person so that they can get their needs met, right? The second kind of love, though, is friendship love. We're going to come back to that one. He describes this as the real bond that's kind of the glue of true Christian relationships. Thirdly, he calls eros love, which is that romantic fundamental love that exists between a man and a woman. And then finally, he talks about something that he calls charity. A lot of people, some of you grew up in religious circles, will be familiar with the Greek word that we use for that kind of word, the word agape. I got to be kind of trendy there for a while. Like, we want agape love. Charity is how Lewis puts it in the book. And what it is it's that deeply powerful, committed love. It's like, it's not marital love in the sexual sense. It's marital love in the I am bound to you sense. If you ever look throughout the Psalms, you constantly have the psalmist talking about God's unfailing love. What are the other translations of that in other versions? Joel and Brian, Bible people here. Who else are? The unfailing love, the committed love. There's all these different ways of talking about that sort of like binding love, as it were. That's charity. Well, here's what Lewis says. Lewis says, contrast for a minute eros and friendship love in terms of what it is that you are looking at. He says, in eros love, the couple is actually focused on each other. The person who's experiencing erotic love is infatuated and taken with the physical presence of the other person. They are looking at them. They're looking at their smiles. They're looking at their history together. They're looking at their bodies, whatever. There's an erotic connection that exists as people are looking at each other. But he contrasts that with friendship love in that that's not two people looking at each other. He goes, that's actually a sick relationship when it's outside of marriage. He says what it is two people actually looking towards a common horizon. Friendship love happens when the two of you are focused on the same thing. This is what we were talking about last week. You can experience a sense of oneness, as it were, when you have something that the two of you have gotten in common. You might say, we love the same music. Well, it'd be a great thing. We're not going to do this morning, but go around and find out exactly what it was that kind of connected you and your spouse at first, right? My guess is you should walk and be like, well, I'm a Christian who knows the Lord. I am too. Let's get together and get married. It's often something that's kind of really silly. I can tell you for Ginger and me, the moment that I thought that we had a potential to have a relationship. So on our very first date, you're going to love this, don't you? Ginger's got that cringe look. She's like, he didn't warn me about this one. But we were sitting there and we were talking about the great profound philosophical topic of Looney Tunes cartoons. All right? This is one of the best things we've ever talked about on a first date. We were talking about the greatness of these particular cartoons. And someone was saying, well, I love this cartoon. We were double dating, as a matter of fact. We were in the Cafe Espresso in East Memphis at this point. I can remember vividly where we were. And everybody was talking about their favorite cartoon growing up. And I said, without question, the greatest cartoon of all time ever made is the Michigan J. Frog, One Froggy Evening cartoon. Okay? If you remember that the whole premise is where this construction guy is digging up an old building and he pulls out a time machine or a time, capsule, and he pulls out this little box and out dances this little frog. And the frog sings, everybody loves the Michigan Rang, right? But that's the deal. That's all he'll do, and he'll only perform for the guy. What's fascinating about this cartoon is there's not one word of dialogue. The only speaking part is by that singing frog, right? Jump, hop, hop the Michigan. And what he does, he ends up completely bankrupting the guy who finds him because he'll only perform for him because the guy thinks he's going to make all this money with his singing, performing frog. So I am doing what I'm doing right now, which is extolling the virtues of One Froggy Evening. In my opinion, oh, now I've forgotten the creator's name. This is what happens in your 50s. Chuck Jones. Chuck Jones is the greatest Looney Tunes artist of all time. He was the director of this particular thing. Everybody agrees it's the best. And at that very moment, Ginger stood up, pushed back from her chair, and she was like, that's the best cartoon ever. I love that. I was just talking with my big brother about that cartoon. And inside me, I thought, this has potential. Now, but here's the crazy thing. Have Ginger and I spent every waking day talking about One Froggy Evening? No. We've watched it many times, just as sort of a sense of rejoicing. That was what I would call a superficial horizon. Following? Something that we both connected on that all suddenly I thought, I want to ask her out again. But that's what happens with every friendship. You find something that someone will come alongside you to look at, and you'll see a friendship that's forming, right? Could be about anything. It could be movies. It could be music. It could be a cause, right? We're going to work on getting this thing done. And all of a sudden, we discover that there's a deep oneness that's being established there. So the deep oneness that comes from two people journeying towards a common horizon is how the Bible, unpacks this, which is where we get all of our conversations like we had this morning about what this naked and unashamed language is about. So here's the question. Clearly, Looney Tune cartoons are not quite the common horizon that's going to give you a lifetime of friendship with someone. How does a Christian understand what that ultimate common horizon is? What is, for a Christian, the ultimate common horizon? Well, I do think at that point we've got to go back to the chapter in Genesis, where you see when God creates the world, in Genesis 1, verse 2, He notes that before anything else is created, there are two problems with reality. Do you remember the two descriptions? The earth was without form and void. Those were the two problems. That as you look out across the world, they lacked the forms, but then they lacked the substance to fill up those forms. And so what you have is the first 3 days of creation being the ways in which those forms get established. And then the latter 3 days are where the substance get filled up in those forms. You follow me? That's that little parallelism you get that Hebrew writing does all the time. That's what creation was laid out for. I would argue that this is exactly what we're dealing with as friendships and people. Because we have a God who, as the Spirit is hovering over the waters, is taking chaos and bringing order and form to it, and then filling it up with something good. Because with Genesis chapter 3, what Brian was doing last week and what I'm going to deal with even this morning, is you begin to see that when the chaos enters, things begin to go back to their chaotic state. The forms break down, and the way in which that void begins to open up again. It's a great way of describing the human condition outside of Christ, is it not? Even the soul can be formless and void. And what happens is, as formlessness and void begin to take over a people's consciences, they equally begin to create the world around them that suffers from the same thing. And so when God begins to work, and we're going to see this later on in Genesis, this is actually going to happen in November when we look at Abraham. When God calls Abraham, what he says to him is, I am calling you out, Abraham, from all these people, and your descendants, he's not just talking about Jewish people, by the way, because the Apostle Paul says all of God's people are descendants of Abraham. But he says the people that I'm calling out are actually going to be the ones who are a blessing to the nations. What's that promise mean? That means that every Christian person has a mission. We all have a mission. We all have a reason. And that is to be about the business of seeing formlessness and void and trying to bring ministry to it. No matter what you're doing. I am working in the hopes that my job, however mundane you think it is bringing order where there's chaos. I'm doing my little part, my tiny little microscopic part. That's where I want to be. I am having children for the hopes that those children will continue the work of advancing the mission of God in the kingdom of pushing back formlessness and void. Ready for this one? I got married, in God's conception, I would argue, in order to advance this kingdom, which is why God looks down and says, Adam needs a helper that is suitable for him. And that helper is not condescending, by the way, ladies. It's actually quite an honor, because we also find that God himself is referred to as Israel's helper. It's that thing that without which you're not complete. That's what it means to be a helper. So yes, a man is not complete. And Jerry Maguire is far more wise than we thought he was, right? Yeah, so this is the place when God says, let us make man in our image after our likeness, let them have dominion. That's the whole thing. We're here to exercise that dominion over all these things. And God blessed them and said to them, be fruitful and multiply, fill the earth, subdue it, have dominion over all these fish, the sea, birds of the heavens, and every living thing. That is the fundamental call. It's for mankind to live in God's good world, pushing back the effects of sin and bringing out all the potentialities that God has. Now, here's my question. Honestly, how often do you ever think about that as my reason for being here? I don't know. I'm getting older, and so you start to think like, I'm not going to do the death discussion anymore. Everybody's like, thank goodness we're not going to do that. Let's talk about it in terms of this. Oh, it's really dark. Okay, so this is the screenshot from the movie Tolkien. There's no question that one of the better examples you get from the 20th century anyway of the idea of friendships was pictured in J.R.R. Tolkien and his friendship with C.S. Lewis, Jack, affectionately they were called, John and Jack. There was another guy named Charles Williams who was part of a little club they had, where they had a little, they would meet in a pub on a twice weekly basis, and they called themselves as a club the Inklings. And they would sit together and they would bring their manuscripts, they would bring their study stuff that came along. But what was interesting was Tolkien all this time was working on his great monumental work, The Lord of the Rings. And if you've ever read The Lord of the Rings, it's a fascinating discourse on the idea of friendship. Indeed, you could argue that the sort of action of the whole show, of the whole book and literature, is advanced by Frodo and Sam's friendship. And Sam's commitment to Frodo and Frodo's commitment to Sam as they march onto the fires of Mount Doom. But it's interesting, when they made the movie version of what went on, the people who put the movie together noticed this incredible friendship that existed between Tolkien and a friend of his named Geoffrey Smith. So Geoffrey Smith we don't hear much about, and here's the reason why. Because Smith was actually killed in combat in World War I. And it was actually wounded in combat and died, you know, a couple of weeks later from his particular wounds. What was really interesting was when they were interviewing Anthony Boyle, and I think that's the guy on the left, who played Smith in the movie. He said, look, Smith was actually Tolkien's real soulmate. And he had, in his research for the role, what he had found is that as for his last act on Earth, even though he was hit by the shrapnel of this bomb or grenade or whatever it was that took his life, that in the last time of his life before he died, he sat down and wrote a letter to his friend Tolkien. And it really moved this actor, Anthony Boyle. And he said, look, he said, I think that's the most beautiful act of love there is. If you were dying, who would be your first call? Like, that shook me in a big way. If I were dying, who would be my first call? He says, that was his. I love the way Hollywood puts it. And I think there's something really special about that. That literally is what he told Inverse magazine when he said that. So what you've got is this beautiful idea of friendship being illustrated. Let me throw out a couple of thoughts about what the Bible says about how to have a friend, and then I want to hear what you think. What are some tips that you've picked up over the years that help understand what friendship is? The first one is this one. Ginger and I, when we lived in Memphis together, had a little tiny little house we lived in a nice neighborhood, High Point Terrace in Memphis. And there was a guy who lived right next to us named Charlie. Charlie was 80 back in 1994 and the sweetest guy ever. And on one occasion, you know, well, it was a thing for me to forget to bring the garbage out. It was just a thing. I had a problem with it. So on one particular occasion, I noticed that Charlie, the 80-year-old man, had taken our garbage to the edge so that it could be picked up by the people. Okay, yes, to my shame, right? And so I walk out to Charlie, and I'm kind of like, you know, Charlie, like, you don't have to do that. He said, well, he said, I've always lived by one creed. If you want to have good friends, you ought to be a good friend. And I've always thought to myself, I will always think of that. And I'll always think of Charlie whenever I think about that. But the part of having a friend that can often be so difficult is waiting for me to have good friends. That's not the deal. Friendships happen when I sort of push myself out to where I'm the one who's reaching out. What do I want from others, and how do I provide that? How do I exercise that in the life of other people? Secondly, we have to wrestle with this question like, Les, I'm just not wired that way. I know there's a lot of people that are into all that touchy-feely friendship stuff. I'm just not that guy. I'm happy to be by myself. Hey, just put me with a book and alone. I'm done with people. I don't need that. Brené Brown, like I quoted from last week, she actually comes at these people pretty hard. She says, you know, she goes, I get worried about the people who say, I don't care what people think. These people send up a huge red flag for me because we are hardwired for that connection. And when we stop caring what people think, we lose our capacity for connection. When we become defined by what people think, then we lose our capacity to be vulnerable. I love this. She goes, not caring what people think, acting like I'm just not wired that way, is its own form of hustle. She loves to talk. So we talked about this morning about the fig leaves that Adam and Eve sort of covered themselves with when they notice that they're naked. She uses that same language for hustling. Like, I've got my job, but then I got this little side hustle over here that I'm really kind of using to keep my life together over here. And she's like, yeah, sort of putting up this facade that says I really don't need other people around me, I'm a loner, is its own kind of hustle, she says. You can push back on me on that one if you want. Thirdly, yeah, we got to embrace the awkwardness. Everybody is awkward, and if you learn to embrace that, you realize that no one's awkward. Have you ever thought about that? If everybody's awkward, then no one's awkward. It's weird for everybody. And somebody has got to make the first move towards potential friendships before these relationships can happen. And again, so in other words, when we're trying to make friends, we got to do that in such a way of actually inviting them to come along and do something with me. Have you ever noticed that kid in high school that you knew who wanted friends so badly never had them? Isn't that interesting? Because the friendship became the point, not the thing that you were doing. What you're looking for is someone else who shares your same thing, even if it's superficial, and even some of the greater things that we put together in terms of Christian fellowship. Here's my last thought, the value of repetition. Oftentimes you make friends not because you discover this, you like that too, this is wonderful. Sometimes you make friends because you just do the same thing over and over again. I love this idea. I read an article about these two men. They were interviewed in an Alabama newspaper. They live in Birmingham. And they both were musicians, and they kept meeting up at these gigs that they would play at, and they kept saying the same thing to each other for a year. Dude, we have got to hang out. Until finally, one of them, the more creative type, was like, here's what we're going to do. He found out that his friend moved like a mile and a half away from him. He goes, one time a week, we're going to walk to each other, and we're going to give each other a high five. And the guy was like, that's the dumbest thing I've ever heard of. He's like, I know, right? He said, but if we do it for like 10 years, they'll put us on CBS Morning News, which apparently were their wives' favorite TV show. So literally that's the only reason they're trying to get on the news by high-fiving each other every week for 10 years in a row, literally. So they talk about, I've got all this interview, it's really funny. He says, So he says, it was at 8:05 on April 3rd, 2014, we texted and said, all right, let's leave our houses. We met at the middle, gave each other a high five, and then we weren't sure what to do. So we sat there and talked for 3 hours. The only rule at the beginning was that we had to do it one time each week, and we developed a little bit of a handshake, which was a hand slap and then sort of a high five. He said we would talk for 15 minutes, and then we'd go back home, and we made sure we did it once a week. This was their pattern, right? Well, what happened was, as time went on, 6, 7, or 8 years later, one of the other guys was opening a little restaurant. And it was right there on the path to their high five. So what he would do is he would simply do it on the way to work. He'd find this guy and do the high five. But he said, one day at work, he said, and this is his quote, I just started feeling weird. And he suddenly begins to get very foggy about the details of what it was that happened. And he went to the emergency room and basically said, I don't know what the details were, but I was diagnosed as having encephalitis, which of course causes memory loss. Horrible sort of tragic thing. He said, my particular version of it gave me less short-term memory. I just began forgetting these things. And he said, so the other guy looks up and says, he goes, that's all I remember about me getting sick. That's all I remember. But then the other friend pipes up and he goes, yeah, but let me tell you what happened in the hospital. He said, I tried to go into the hospital a week later because we didn't know whether he was even going to make it or not. And I looked at his wife and I said, look, I'll stay the night with him. Let me have the nighttime shift. And so he goes, okay, fine. And as he says, he was talking to his friend who could actually remember him. He knew that his friend was there. But he looked and he said to him, he said, look, I'm going to be here with you for the night. He said, but here's what I want you to do. He said, if you get up and go to the bathroom, he said, when you come out, I want you to give me a high five. And the guy goes, what are you talking about? He said, dude, for the last 8 years, you and I have been giving each other high fives. He's like, I got no idea what you're talking about. So the guy gets up about an hour later and runs to the restroom. And on his way out of the restroom, his friend stands up and walks to him and starts to do the thing. And all of a sudden, he does the slap, slap, high five. And all of a sudden, the guy just started busting into tears. And he was like, that you hung on to. Even as your mind began to be diseased, there was that one repetition, because we always did it together, that their mind held on to. The patterns that get established when true friendship happens. And this is what he said. He says, one of the things that I loved was the routine of it. Not just the mechanics of it, but the friendship part of it is so burned into my body memory that was what came out of me. He says, I was in the hospital for 3 weeks, and I got out around the beginning of October, and I've just been trying to find my life again, and this guy is a huge part of it. That thing that we started years ago has now come back to be so important. Friendship. What you got? What are your ideas of friendship? What are things that you've heard that have been important to you? What are the friends that meant the most to you that you felt like could have some life lessons for the rest of us this morning? Yeah, Brian. Yeah. I mean, an introvert may feel a different struggle. They're like, I don't know how to make one friend. That feels like a particularly Brian Sorgenfrei struggle, because I want to be friends with everybody. I wouldn't even know how to answer that, because I'm stricken with the exact same thing. But I do think that oftentimes I find myself pining after something that is simply not possible because I just didn't make that life choice. There's a sense in which you have to apologize for making preacher jokes all the time. And this is the thing about preacher jokes. They're never funny. I mean, never. They're barely funny to the preachers that say it back and forth to each other, right? But here's the thing. Like, that's where God has me. And so the connections that you end up having are the people that were part of your life in ministry. And so there's a part of me that's, again, in my 50s where I look back and I'm like, I don't know that just the warp and woof of life gives me the ability to have any kind of sense of connection with other people. And my goal is not necessarily to have the same levels of friendship. I do think the body of Christ ought to function as the biggest umbrella of friendship, that I can never really say that I'm truly alone. And I'm not saying that every church does a perfect job at making people feel like they're enfolded and part of the body. That's as it may be. And sometimes we do that better as a church. Other times we do it poorly as a church. But I can still get the sense that, like, I can still have a generalized idea. It's like, I belong there. That's what church membership is about. But as far as the temptation to feel like I can't be friends with everybody, that to me that smells a little bit like its own idolatry. Something in there is like, what is my compulsion here? Because I know that that's not, I'm not capable of that in other areas, but there's something in there that smells of something that I'm wanting that's not really about the friendship. The friendships are the ones that, again, they probably just came through this repetition, right? Where I just did the same things over and over again. Yeah, you and I just keep finding each other in each other's lives. Yeah. It's part of it. You ain't got any choice to be friends with me, Brian. That's your own fault. Yes, true.
I think you can learn older than you.
Yeah, that's a great thought. Yeah, you need to have friends that are older than you, that are younger than you. And that's true in the faith as well. People that you feel like are more advanced than you are in the faith, and people that you feel like are just learning to grow and figure things out. But yeah, your friendships will be super formational. And if you can actually sort of be self-aware of that, you know, that I've got people that are older than I am in different phases of life. You know, we've wrestled a whole lot in this church about whether or not to do age-differentiated Sunday school classes, and we very may well go to those things. But there's still some value in the fact that, like, you know, the single mom is here, the aging couple is here, the college student is here, all in this very room. And we're picking up all kinds of stuff with each other, are we not? That's great advice. Yeah, what you got? Yeah, we're going out together and getting drunk together and stuff like that. I'm teasing. I'm teasing. I'm just teasing you. That's what made it funny. Imagine y'all going out, riding with the top down. Have you ever noticed, though, when you talk that way, it always makes me think, I get emotional when I hear people talk about their friends, how much they love their friends. And I think that friendship is the stuff that we get emotional about. If I think about my old girlfriends, I don't have that kind of emotional reaction. Does that make sense? You know, the things that were all romantical and stuff. Ginger's like, thank you. But I'll say this, but when you talk about the way someone was there for you and was faithful with you in that, you're like, man, that's the stuff of life, you know? And maybe that's what we are in for on the other side of this life. And in your 50s, you get kind of preoccupied with the other side, don't you? You see what's coming and like, what happens on the other side of this life? And the answer is there's friendships waiting. That's why we sing in our hymn, you know, up where partings are no more. That's what Emmanuel's land is all about, where these departures don't ever have to happen anymore. So, good. Hey, thank y'all. It's 10:30. We got 15 minutes for worship. Let me pray for us, and we will finish out our time together. Lord Jesus, give us grace then to build good friendships. Some of us feel a vacuum inside of us that we realize we don't have any good friends, and we really don't know what to do. Maybe if you could intervene in that behalf and make us a church of great friendships. And even whatever it takes to do that, we need your help and your spirit to guide us into it. Would you do that in Jesus' name?